other side of the street I knew. Stood a girl that looked like you. I guess that's deja vu, but I thought this can't be true, cause you moved to West LA or New York or Santa Fe or wherever to get away from me.
All right, if it's Thursday, that means it's time to do the Lynch and Kenny event. So joining me from Texas, Tim Lynch. Tim, what's going on?
Not much, Matt. Glad to be here.
All right. Glad to hear your voice. And Jeff Kenny joins us from a parking lot someplace. Camp Pendleton. Jeff, what's up?
That's right. I hang out here and I look at all the homeless people. Actually, they're out in Pendleton, but.
You know, yep. The homeless population, the veteran homeless population, is, I saw an article today, it's down 50% from 2009. So in 10 years, the veteran, it was down again 2% this year, it was down 5% last year, and it's down 50% since 2009. How about that?
Yeah, it's good.
What did they attribute that to?
A program begun by the Obama administration, continued under President Trump, that got veterans into housing and off the street, and then also in conjunction with that, gave them kind of a caseworker that helped them get mental health services and other things.
Right. So, wow. Awesome.
Yeah, no, I mean, good news. You don't hear very many good news stories about veteran mental health and veteran homelessness, but I was shocked. Ben Carson was someplace doing something and made some comments about that, and that somebody turned it into an article. So I was like, holy smokes, man. That's awesome. That's awesome. How bad is a lot of homeless people in and around Camp Pendleton?
No, there is there's a couple there in Oceanside you see every once in a while, like if you go downtown for anything.
Right.
But, and then for a while up in San Clemente, they had a big problem on North Beach. For some reason, they just all clustered there. And, I mean, hundreds of them, right there along that promenade that runs from North Beach down to where the pier is and all that stuff. And,
right.
And then they relocated them in a, on Pico, if you're familiar with that,
yep.
Going towards, where the high school is, there's like a big lot that's, you know, enclosed by a big metal fence, and they're in there now, supposedly. And every once in a while you hear about them doing something like running out into traffic as if they're trying to get hit, you know, so they, you know what I'm saying, that there's a complaint about that. I haven't seen any of that myself personally, but I did walk him the dog down there on the, on the beach area there at North Beach, see them, they're like, it was like the railroad scene and Gone with the Wind with all the wounded dudes. Like, they weren't wounded. They're just drunk and high. and then, like I say, they moved them up. They got them to move up to that area about a half mile away.
Yeah, that's, it's in warm weather places. I mean, what is the estimate? Close to 90,000 people are homeless in Los Angeles. Congregating mostly on the west side of Los Angeles where the beautiful people live because you can get more money when you panhandle and the lawns are nicer to sleep on.
Yeah, same thing up in San Fran.
Yeah.
They're up there close to the, I think they're like, they're close to Nancy Pelosi's house and all that. You know?
Yeah, no, I've heard San Francisco is an absolute shithole now.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Northern California, and San Francisco going there was always the prize. And now I have friends who tell you, yeah, we don't go there anymore.
Yeah, it's like my best friend, who Mike Maiman, who was we were on a missy duty together. His dad moved them into San Francisco purposely in the 60s when they got back from overseas because of the school system. The public school system in San Francisco is the number one in the nation. And then in the 70s, like late 70s, it started going down, you know. But to where it's horrid now. But, yeah, it was a beautiful place from what I hear.
Yeah, you know, I have a, you know, one of the things that's interesting that I've learned in my time, as I've learned so much doing post-traumatic winning is, I'd be curious about your guys' thoughts about this, but, you know, the problem that the nation has with suicide is not a mental health problem. It's not people that are schizophrenic. It's not people that are bipolar. It's not people that are manically depressed that are causing that number to go up. It's people that are simply overwhelmed by life who don't see the upside anymore and only see the downside, and they take their own life. Well, that's a coping issue, right? That's not a mental health issue. And so, and I think, in my opinion, all this shit that has come into our school system, right? And that you don't face consequences and we do away with adversity and blah, blah, blah. You haven't helped them. You have sown the seeds that are being reaped now because they don't have the coping skills. They don't have the coping skills. So anyway, your thoughts on that? Timmy, you haven't said anything yet.
Well, I was gonna talk about our homeless problem down here because we don't have one.
Why?
And it's because you know how excellent Mexican American and Hispanic NCOs are. I mean the ones that rise up to sergeant, staff sergeant, take great pride in their uniform, and are very, very strict. You know, they're disciplinarians. They're very family oriented, and that's basically the law enforcement down here. They do not tolerate virtually any public ordinance, flaunting of the public ordinance, and there are no homeless down here. Because if they are, they're probably going to be Hispanic, and if they're drunk and indignant, the Border Patrol will roll them up. So they've got no chance down here.
Really? So they're either moved along to someplace else?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. They are encouraged to hike it on out of here. There are a derelict row of maybe 5 or 6 guys, but they're local guys. You can't come into McAllen and winter like a snowbird. We've already got, we double our population in the winter with what we call winter Texans, what Floridians call snowbirds.
Right.
We call them winter Texans. Our economy actually depends on them in a great extent. And so they don't tolerate any of that nonsense down here. Not a bit of it.
Wow.
When Trump came to go tour with the border police, I went out to this anti-Trump protest where there were more Trump protesters. I wrote about it in the blog. And there was an anti-fog guy that showed up, only one, and he got out of a car, and I was watching this. And I think he got 3 steps before he got gang-tackled by the police and thrown into a squad car. It was hysterical because they just don't play that game down here at all.
The looking for trouble in Texas, we don't play that game?
Yeah. No. As to your point about the nation's suicide problems, you are not mimicking, but there was a guy named Yohan Hari who wrote a book called Lost Connections. It was a big bestseller, I think 2 summers ago, and that's exactly his point. It's a long book. It buttresses your argument exactly at the end of it. And his contention is a lack of meaning and a sense of purpose. That's the problem, and he says that's the problem also with the addiction crisis. That seems to be something he writes about in 2 different books on it.
Well, Frankl writes that in Man's Search for Meaning, and he's writing in the 70s and early 80s, and that he's saying, look, how's he say it? The modern neurosis is an abundance of time and a lack of purpose, and those 2 things coupled, right, make for bad things for people who don't have meaning in their lives. And so they go into this spiral, and he said, what people are going to see mental health professionals for now, you know, in the past they would have gone to see a pastor for.
Right.
They can't cope. They don't know what to do. And so Frankl's talking about this and he said it's only going to get worse in the future. I'm not even sure he could envision, you know, what it is today where – you know, you don't do adversity growing up. You don't develop that one critical skill, and that is how do you overcome adversity? You know, because you don't do it. You're not allowed to do it. You know, I think the culture is reaping what it sows. And so what's the solution, right? Let them fail. Fail them.
Yeah.
Right? Fail them.
Yeah.
Give them what they deserve because, you know, I always say, you know, things you never hear a kid say, hey, Grandpa, let me show you all the participation medals I got for playing soccer when I was little. Like, you've never heard any kid say that in their life because those medals are of no value. That's why they wind up in a heap in a shoebox in a closet because that's where your mom puts them because they're worthless. The only thing that provides you esteem is that which you earn. And you don't have to, and kids know that. You can't bullshit kids and give them esteem because, oh, look, Johnny, here's an award for you. And we're not going to recognize his or her excellence and say, we don't have an MVP anymore, because that would make somebody feel bad. You can't, you can't give people esteem like that.
You know, that is a common mistake, even in the military, because like my last duty station there at Tumas, they're talking about you get one award per tour for guys, you know, who are going to, in some cases, harm's way. And I'm like, so what if they had that during the Second World War? Audie Murphy would have got, like, he would have got a Bronze Star. And what, is it nothing else you do?
Right.
He could pile up the Purple Hearts.
Right.
There's better examples than being on Marine Radio. We can use a campaign cover. Remember how the Army imported that and a chance to try to match the mystique of the DI? Also, the beret now. I don't know. The Army still wear the beret? Remember when they transitioned to the beret?
Yeah.
To make everybody feel like nobody's special?
Right.
Nah, yeah. Dude. It never worked.
Right.
Shinseki, I saw a cartoon. I was going through command staff when Shinseki became chief of staff of the Army. And he came up with that idea, everybody gets a beret. And they had a cartoon, one of these guys, and it showed Marine D.I., a guy wearing a campaign cover. Roman Legionnaire, a guy with the Roman helmet on. And then it had Chief of the Sioux Nation, a guy with an Indian headdress. Chief of Staff of the Army, and it showed Shinseki sitting on a tall stool with a dunce cap on, you know? And it was just funny as hell, but exactly. It's like trying to make everybody feel special. It's like Gilbert and Sullivan, you know? If everybody's somebody, then no one's anybody.
Wait, keep singing. That was good.
Okay. No, that's all I know. I know other fits and snatches, you know, but me and Dave used to sit there and laugh about them, you know. But,
my God. Let me just tell you this. I had another person on Saturday call me or on Facebook me and just said, Mac, I just pulled off the road. My XO, when I was a company commander, he's in Europe. I just pulled off the road because I had tears in my eyes listening to Jeff Kenny's story about getting kicked in the balls and his shirt pulled over his head in Tehran. I swear to God, I have people messaging me all the time, man. That is like possibly the funniest story ever relayed on All Marine Radio, which says a lot because there's been a lot of funny shit that goes over these airways.
Yeah. I mean, it was shit like that happened every week.
Right.
But it just happened to me that week.
Listen to this little vignette. I was doing my first, when I was second lieutenant, I checked into Charlie Company 1-5, and I was the platoon commander for 3rd Platoon. So I go do post-traumatic winning last Thursday and Friday for 1-5. And so they split the battalion in half. Charlie Company comes on Friday, right, with whoever else, weapons and headquarters and whoever. So I'm standing there, I'm like, all right, everybody in Charlie Company, stand the fuck up. Everybody's looking around like, what's going on? I'm like, all right, everybody else, the finest Marines in the Marine Corps, this company right here, so eat it if you ain't in it. And everybody started screaming and yelling, laughing. And I said, all right, everybody but 3rd Platoon, sit down. 3rd Platoon, stand there. I said, the finest Marines in the Marine Corps, you're looking at right there. And everybody's like, no way. And I said, that's my platoon. So I said, don't go anywhere after this. We got to take a picture. So we're taking a picture. I said, all right, look, nobody's smiling, right? No stupid grins, and nobody better photobomb this shit either. And so they're laughing. And so we take a picture. And I said, thanks, guys. I said, you know, in 1984, you know, this platoon used to be called the Goon Platoon. And they look at me like, sir, we're still the Goon Platoon. And I said, no fucking way. And they're like, yep, we are. And one of the Marines takes his shirt off, right? So on the front, it's got over the breast pocket, it has a little logo, and then it says Goon Platoon on the back. Across the shoulders, Goon Platoon, right? A skull in a cowboy hat with crossed M4s behind it. And underneath it, it said, no fucking slack. I'm like, take your shirt off, bro. That's mine. He's like, sorry. Sorry, sir, you got to buy this. I'm like, well, how do I get one? And like, whoa, we're going to have to make some more. I said, let me just tell you this. When my Marines find out that you're still the Goon Platoon, they're going to lose their minds, all right? They're going to lose their minds. But I'll tell you what, it was awesome. And like normal, I mean, the number of Marines that came up to talk and say, can you help me help somebody else? What do I do with somebody who won't talk about it? You know, and it was awesome. But I thought you guys, yeah, Goon Platoon still lives, man. I have a picture of at the EAF. We're getting ready to fly. The rest of the battalion was going on buses. Our Jeep and trailer, that's right, Jeep, okay?
Yep, 151.
When men were men and got issued steel pots, not Kevlar, okay? And we carried the .45, right? Boom, bitches. So anyway, when my platoon, I had a good platoon, right? We became the best platoon in the company. And so after the CACs, we're getting ready to fly back, and company commander says, Mac, you want to... your platoon's going to get on the C-130. So, like, we had a 45-minute ride, and everybody else is going to be right on buses for, 5 hours or some shit, right? And so, and the Jeep's in the center of the 130, chained down, right?
Right.
And then the pilot bounces that bitch on the air facility at Camp Pendleton, right? The Jeep's bouncing up and down. Marines are yelling, shit! But it was awesome. But they had a MRE sleeve, and I don't know why we took the picture. We took a picture, and it says Goon Platoon on it. So I sent that to him. I said, well done, boys. There's your lineage. And so I'm talking shit about my platoon, right, on my show on Friday. And so I thought, so I pull up the Wikipedia page for 1-5 to read its lineage and whatnot. And I'm scrolling down. All of a sudden I look. I'm like, holy fuck, that's me.
Yeah,
there's a platoon. No. Yes, yes. There's a picture on there from my platoon in 1985 at the aforementioned CACs, and we had gone index, and we spent the night out, you know, in our positions, and my platoon sergeant, who I had at the end, a guy named Rich Stebbins. He's a dog handler.
Oh. Rich Stebbins, a buddy of mine. We were sergeants together in 3-5.
Rich Stebbins was a dog handler in Vietnam.
Yeah, he's a broken time guy.
Yeah.
He's a dog handler in Vietnam. He's from Connecticut.
Yeah, he is.
About 15 miles from me in Connecticut.
He's working over at the base operations center.
No shit, because he just befriended me on Facebook.
Listen to this. Do you remember when we had the big fire at Pendleton, 85? That huge fire?
No, I was in college then. But yeah.
So I'm working for the MEF, and I'm working in the operations center, and I call over to the base operations center because General Tulin, I mean, this fire was not going to, you know, destroy the base, right? So General Tulin's like, I'll fly every helicopter, water sorties, but the base was like, no, the firefighting guys said we're just going to let it burn. And we're like, what? Let it burn, but it's what they do, right? But we were not like...
Now it's into science.
Yeah, we were like all spun up. Let's fight this bitch. Let's everybody. So anyway, so I call the base operations center, and I hear, you know, I call the COC or the OC, and I hear base operations center, Rich Seven speaking. And I don't even say who I am, right? I said, were you a dog handler in Vietnam? And he says... Yeah, I was. And I said, are you from Connecticut? And he said, I am. And I said, what's up, motherfucker? And I said, this is Lieutenant McNamara. How about getting on your fucking feet? And he's like, what in God's name is wrong with you?
You know, I think he was Fergie's platoon sergeant, too.
Was he?
Yeah.
Holy
shit.
Because
I was talking to Fergie in the back of the fucking letter apartments for drinking. Yeah, I had to look at one of those things, and Fergie's talking about Rich Stebbins, his platoon sergeant. And I met him in 79 when I got to 3-5, when Gunny Stepp got me to 3-5.
Just so you know, Ronnie Lee Stepp will live in my mind forever now.
Yeah.
You've immortalized him.
Yeah, he was an unusual guy. Like, he's the call. Like, where
well, hold on, let me finish my Rich Stebbins story, and then I want you to explain the significance of him giving you his annotated 6-5, okay? Because you say that in the story, but I want to talk about that for a second. Anyway, so we finish, and it's one of those nights in 29 Palms where it's like 30 degrees, And, you know, we didn't have, like, cold weather gear. We had one weighted gear for the whole year, right? But we had those green bags that were, I mean, were awesome.
Yeah.
And you threw your poncho liner and your poncho over the top of you. I mean, come on, man. You were good. So we're talking shit and we're staying up. And now, you know, we can build a little fire, but there's no wood. So Stebbins goes and gets, like, some kind of fuel in a 5-gallon drum. And he says, okay, he says, watch this. And so we're all standing around, and he's going to build a fire. And he builds out of dirt, he builds this little pool. And then up the little slope of the hill, he builds like a little canal. And then at the top, he takes the gas can, and he tips it over, so the gas is running down this little moat into the little pool. And then, now we're all standing around like, Stebbins gonna, like, this Vietnam ship, Stebbins gonna build a fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is gonna be awesome. So he lays the gas can down and it's trickling down the moat, and then he throws a match into the pool, right? And everybody goes, oh, fuck, that's awesome, right? Big flame. Everybody's warming their hands. And now we're watching as the flame goes up the moat and like, oh, well, shit, is that supposed to happen like that? Right, and then the shit goes into the can, right? And this thing, I mean, thank God there was not enough fuel to combust in this thing to explode it, right?
Shrapnel and stuff.
Right, so what happens, it becomes a flamethrower, right? Because the aperture is wide enough to accommodate the combustion. Right? Right, and then everybody's like, fuck! And as we all know, it's all fun in the Marine Corps, right, until somebody gets hurt. And nobody really got hurt. So they're pissing their pants laughing and looking at him like, Staff Sergeant, like, what the fuck, man? And he's like, it didn't work like that last time. And I'm looking at him like, you're fucking stupid, man.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
That was stupid, but Rich Stebbins. So talk about the significance of Gunny Stepp, an infantry Marine, giving your boot ass his annotated version of the 6-5.
Well, here's the thing: he said you should go for Super Squad because the training is great. Gunny was 0341, and he went for Super Squad because they're opening it to guys from Weapons Company, or it wasn't even Weapons Company. And when he was a young Marine, 81s was part of H&S, and the 60s were in the companies, but then the 60s, like when I looked at 3-5 at the time, there were no more 60s in the company. It was really bad. And then they started when, in 1981 or so, we started adding the shit back in. But, so he had a 6-5, and what he annotated it, he put a bunch of Mortarman stuff in there to make it, like, relevant. Like, he would, instead of doing call for fire, he taught his guys how to do, like what we were teaching lieutenants at IOC with fire commands, a visualization of where you were in order to, and that was a big impressive thing. This is like when, in the 60s, when, right, when he was, you know, so there was that. And then he had a bunch of other annotations about, about how to do, when you don't have shackle sheets. I mean, he wrote in the back of 6-5, how to do, your own fucking version of shackle sheets. What you did is he had two words that he used. Scuba diver, which is a recon thing, S being 0, and R being 9. You understand what I mean?
Right.
So you can, and then the other one was tiger's fuck, which is what they did in Vietnam, which is the same thing, T being 0 and K being 9. So you could fucking do numbers, and as long as you knew tiger's fuck or scuba diver, you know, you didn't need the fucking check. Pretty, it was like in a pun. So I'm talking to lieutenants at PEX with that Kiwi was running after you left, Mac. And this kid goes, you know, I don't know how to do it. And I whip Tiger's fucking scuba diver on him. And they're like, and Mac and Kiwi goes, see that? You learned something.
That is awesome. But you know what? I love that shit about the Marine Corps, right? Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like normal dudes who come from the heartland and all over the country who are like, yeah, well, look, why don't we just do this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
He was not popular as a company gunny. And wherever he stood, for formation, he'd get out there, company, ah, cat, and then he'd fucking chew our asses and shit, right? Well, somebody drew a picture of somebody getting flipped a bird, like a hand with the middle finger sticking out, right where he always stood. So he goes, company, ah, cat, and he looks down and goes, was this intended for me? Well, fuck you all, too. He stands there with two fingers out, you know, with a bird in each hand, and we fucking broke up laughing. The whole company, man. Me, well, fuck you all, too.
Come on, man. That shit is priceless, right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
what, sure. That, and when those guys gave a fuck about you, yeah, you didn't let them down, right?
Yeah, he was the guy, like, let me tell you something else. I got a million stories with this guy. I'm shooting, right? I'd be on a rifle range. This is the M16A1. And I'm like, Gunny, I got a problem shooting. I can't, in my mind, I think I might have told you guys, in my mind, I can't know where the black is as separated from the front side post, especially after we blacken the front side post. He goes, you fucking think too much, and you don't have a very big brain. That's a fatal combination. He goes, listen, do this. The Pogue's got this shit called whiteout. This is back before you had computers, you know? You use the fucking smoke pot and smudge your sights, and then you take a drop of this whiteout shit, you just put it right on top of the front sight, and your eye will focus on that white dot in the black. And man, I shot 10 points better after that, you know? And he goes, I had morons who thought too much like you before.
I love that shit, though, man.
Yeah, he was definitely that way. I gotta tell you, I had a dream. I was telling Lori about it. I had a dream I was in, like, Iraq or something, and I'm, like, running behind this squad, like in a Haditha or someplace like that. Dreams, you just all of a sudden there, you know? And I run behind these guys, and it's like a wrecked, built, partially wrecked building, like the J-Dam. Remember the J-Dam Motel in Ramadi?
Right.
Yeah, and these guys, these bad guys, are in there shooting at us. So I turn around. I got an M4 with an aim point on it in the dream. So I look there, and there's my fucking red dot. I shoot a guy. And then the fucking dot disappears, and I hear these grunts going, what the fuck? What the fuck? The shit's out of my Neotech. I just got this. And what it was in the dream, we lost all the fucking, like, all the designators in the Neotech and my aim point. So I say, pull that shit off. And use the iron sights. And they look at me like I got a dick run out of my head. Because they never learned anything on iron sights, right? And I woke up and I go, holy fuck. I tell Lori about the dream. She goes, you are losing your mind. I go, it wasn't a bad dream, like I was scared. We were doing okay, but, you know. I remember,
and they start pulling off. What the hell?
You focus on the front sight. Which rear sight do you use, the big one or the little one? I go, use the big one because we're pretty close. And one of the kids in the dream, one of the kids says, we're going to get in trouble for this shit.
Yeah, how could she say you're losing your mind? That's just like seeping out of the cracks, man. That's just like, that's life.
Aim point or Eotech is even older, you know. She's like, you know, she don't know. So, and it's a dream, you know, so it's like, and we're in bed.
Now, Freud would probably read something into this suddenly all the electronics failing on you stuff.
Yeah.
But what the hell? That's still a good dream. Hey, going to iron sights and everything. You know, always nice to go back to the classics.
It's one of the only dreams I ever had that didn't involve, like, being in class and my look down and my pants are gone, you know? Or something like that.
That is awesome. Do you have any, what's the best birthday experience that you've ever had? Timmy, you grew up in the Marine Corps, your dad in the Marine Corps. Considering all your times in the Marine Corps, do you have a favorite birthday story?
Yeah, from when I was on active duty, I turned 30. We were in Singapore, and I went to we were in the Raffles Hotel bar.
Whoa.
Myself, Willie Buell was with me. There was a lot of the pilots because we were a helicopter company and the pilots.
Hold on. Tell everybody the significance of the Raffles Hotel.
Oh, well, the Raffles Hotel is famous for one thing, for the inventing the Singapore sling, but it is the oldest. Swankiest hotel and bar in the Far East, more or less. I mean, it is friggin' famous.
Yeah.
And
there you go.
And it was my birthday, and I remember that towards the end there was the most polite big guy came down and asked, could we please keep it down? The Prime Minister is trying to go to sleep because we had moved out to a patio or something.
Ooh.
And so we took the hint and went back to the ship, but it was just a nice pleasant evening, you know.
Yeah.
And my second favorite was in 2008, was a surprise in Afghanistan. A bunch of the NGO people wanted to put together a hell of a party for me at my 50th. I had no idea. That was a total surprise to me.
Wow, Jeff, your favorite birthday celebration?
And my birthday or Marine Corps?
Well, fuck your birthday. We don't care about that.
Lori's birthday is the 10th. Lori, my wife.
My son Patrick, I used to look at Patrick when he was a kid and I say, hey, look, your brother has an option whether he goes into Marine Corps or not. You do not. Okay? Just so you know, you're the son of a Marine born on November 10th. You don't have a choice, bro. And he would get pissed, like, whoa, that's bullshit. I'm like, I agree.
I know my rights.
Yeah, I agree it's bullshit. I don't make up the rules, though, Patrick. I'm just down here playing by them, okay? He would get pissed. He would get pissed. And so this is a sad story, but I can't remember what year it was now. We were back from Afghanistan, so it might have been 2012. I'm in Ramadi in 2004. I get interviewed by the radio station that I was working for. You know, I'd grab an Iridium phone and they'd ask, so what's going on at the front? I'm like, yeah, you don't want to know about Ramadi in 2004. Nothing good. And so this farmer gets in the car and he's listening because it was the station the twins used to be on. And he said, I didn't really listen to talk radio very much. So I got in. It was there because I was listening to the twins game. And I'm listening to you, right? And he's got a son in Alpha Company, first recon. And he calls in the radio station. He says, hey, could you say hi to my son? And I said, yeah, what's his name? He said, Riley Pape. And I said, who's he with? He said, he's with first recon. And I said, yeah, I'd say hi to him. So then his wife sends me an email. And says, hey, ask Riley this and tell him I love him. So I called down there. I called the battalion. He said, yeah, he's in Alpha Company. So I called down to Alpha Company. And now I'm working for General Mattis, right? And I called down this company and I'm talking to this corporal. I said, hey, Major McNamara, I'm looking for Corporal Pape. So they're out operating right now. I said, okay, when he gets back, could you give him a message for me? And so finally, I don't know, maybe a week or so later, I get this phone call. Sir, this is Corporal Pape. And I said, and I'd forgotten about it. I said, yeah, how can I help you? He said, you called me? I'm with Alpha Company, First Recon. I said, oh, yeah, Corporal Pape, your mom sent me an email. She wanted me, no, your mommy sent me an email. She wanted me to tell you that she loves you. He's like, come on, sir. I said, I swear to God. And so I had driven a beet truck, a semi-truck in the beet harvest for one of his uncles. So we're shooting the shit. I said, hey, if you ever get to Ramadi, come find me, all right? If I get to Fallujah, I'll come. If you're around, I'll track your ass down. Okay. Well, Alpha Company came to Ramadi and ultimately was conducting those Trojan horse operations in Ramadi for General Mattis. So I used to see him all the time. He leaves and goes home. He's on terminal leave, and he loses control of his motorcycle and goes headfirst into a pole in National City. And so I meet his family at the funeral. And his youngest brother joins the Marine Corps, right? And he graduated from high school like a week after we buried his brother. And then his younger brother goes Alpha Company, 1st Reconnaissance Battalion. He's transitioning to 1st Force when he's killed in a parachute accident.
Well,
yeah, good, the paralock guys don't connect the strap to the chute, and he grabbed that one out of the pile. And static line night jump, right? The longest standing jump in the United States military. And he goes 1,500 feet in 7 seconds. So I've given two flags at funerals, both to the same woman.
Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, why am I telling that story? Birthday. Am I telling the birthday story?
Yeah.
Yeah, with the birthday story you started with.
I can't even remember. Like, how the hell did I connect that to a birthday?
I guess you're getting interviewed.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah. So I'm getting interviewed, and I still can't remember. How does that relate to the birthday? Anyway, fuck it. I screwed up the story. Anyway, that's my best. That's my best story. There you go.
Listen to this one. I mean, you guys might have heard of this, and I'm not the only one that tells this story. There was the Marine Corps ball. I think it was when Timmy and Paul Kennedy were going through AWS, a TBS ball in D.C. We're all there, and there were so many people that they had to have like a big ballroom for most of the people, and then a smaller one where the IOC class we had, the IOC instructors, Herr Schwert, who had taken over IOC by that time.
Shit, I remember this.
And
this has all the elements to be an unmitigated disaster.
So we had to go in to the big ballroom and stand along the sides to hear the guest speaker. This is before they had like closed circuit TVs and shit. But the guest speaker was General Mundy and Colonel Fawcett's last ball. I remember going down from my room and I saw this guy named Captain Nosbitch. You guys remember him?
No.
Oh yeah.
Big thuggish looking dude, right? LAR guy. Went to war, you know, had a Bronze Star and shit. And anyway, this guy, he says, "Jeff, you got an extra fucking Marine Corps emblem for the left collar." And I go, "Fuck yeah, I do. I go, "Are you drunk, Nas?" And he says, "Yeah, we were drinking. I'm okay, though." He's one of the honor guard guys, right?
Oh, shit.
So I always bring my whole jewelry box to the fucking ball in case I forget shit or other. So I get it, I give it to him, and I forget about it, right? Now, they get out there, and Mel is the fucking narrator, Eric Mellinger, with his bald, shiny head, right? And he's lit up, where he is lit up, you know, at like a lectern. And he introduced the commandant, and whoever was in charge of the fucking honor guard. It was like four majors, six captains. It was long, big, you know, a couple of first lieutenants. They're all standing there at attention. And then there was this guy who was an instructor. He was actually, I think, at that point, he was a XO of a company. His name was Jim Hall. Matter of fact, the name of the story is the Jim Hall Ball. So Jim was one of them great guys. Great fucking instructor, great leader, but he would get drunk and make a jerk out of himself. Kind of like Jeff Kenney in 1977.
Imagine that.
He gets in there and he's one of the dudes, he was the XO of the half a company or so we had with us in that fucking extra dining room. So he's there along the wall, right? And he's had a few. And we're all over there. I mean, it's the whole IOC guys, and guys are arguing about tactics. Even then, Killer and fucking Jimmy Bright were about to go to blows over something. So we separate them, and these guys are standing at attention. The commandant starts talking. He goes, "Well, I'd be remiss." You know how General Mundy talks. "I'd be remiss," the older gentleman. "I'd be remiss if I didn't first say thanks to, Jim Hall." Jim Hall yells that. And I'm looking. Everybody's like shocked, right? Except we're all drinking, so people start snickering. And then you look around at everybody. Everybody's got this shocked look at the honor table, you know, the guest of honor table where the CO is and everything. It's like facing everybody else. And everyone's got this shocked look, I think. And then you look over at Mel. He's got his mouth is open. He's fucking shocked. And then the commandant starts talking, and about 2 minutes after that, one of these guys falls on his knees and flat on his face. And so it keeps going like that for the next 15, 20 minutes. Nobody puts these guys at ease, and they're going, and every couple of minutes, the commandant will make a remark, and Jim Hall yells, "Thanks, Jim Hall," or "Say hello to Jim." He yells his own name. And I remember one of them fell and dropped his sword stuck in the parquet floor. And he starts crawling forward. Another guy grabs him by the belt, and he's like, "Oh, fuck." And by this time, half the people are laughing hysterically, like us, and the other half are appalled, right? And the only guy, Colonel Fawcett's sitting there, though. He has no expression on his face. He's just looking into his water glass morosely, you know what I mean? And everything you looked at, I thought I was going to piss myself. I had my hand over my groin because it was just so fucking funny, the Jim Hall ball. You got to have Mel tell you the story because Mel was one of the non-drinking people at first, you know, but it is a fucking pisser, man, that story.
Let me tell you, I called him like the ball, you know, the prom gone wrong, right? So it's all these guys who look great in their uniforms, right? But they're not right in the head. And then you have women that are attracted to guys like that, which means they're really not right in the head. It's like the guys have issues, the girls have more issues. And now they're all wearing, right, the prom dress that their mother would never, ever, ever allow them to buy. Ever.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then you pour liquor on it. Oh yeah. It's a quality event.
You are so right. And, you know, the basic school is better for that than any other
place. Oh, my God, because there's a shit ton of them.
So I had duty, like, the next week, you know, and I'm walking around. I'm walking up in the IG, and somebody had a big picture of a Marine Corps ball celebration. And they got all these, like, they cut out from another magazine, they cut out pictures of 8th and I Marines, and they laid them all over the floor in the IG. And they had remember how we all had our pictures in the the main entranceway by where the CO, the basic school was? We had like little like passport pictures there.
Yeah.
Well, he took Jim Hall's and they blew it up, and he had big Jim Hall's head like in six places, yelling shit, you know. And it was just I'm on duty at like midnight, fucking pissing myself. Look at this thing.
But that's the best part. I remember when I think it was I didn't get to go to the ball because Patrick was born in Quantico. On November 10th, he would have been born. He would have been born on the 495 because we're you know the closest hospital to have a baby was Belvoir, but Belvoir for whatever reason, you know, told us to go to Bethesda. Yeah, can you imagine trying to get to Bethesda from Quantico during? So Susan goes into labor. Thank God it was on November 10th because it was the holiday weekend. And so there was nobody on the interstate. So we get up there. We're going in the hospital, and she's puking in the planner, right? Right? And I'm like, and then she like feels bad about it, right? And I look at her and I'm like, if I was you, I wouldn't give a shit where I puked. I'd puke everywhere I want. Screw their plastic flowers. They probably replace them all the time anyway. And so we get in the room, and the doctor looks at me. And he says, is this your first? I said, no, we have a 3-year-old son. And he said, any idea what it's going to be, boy or girl? I said, doc, do you know what day today is? He's like, Friday? And I'm like, no. It's November 10th. Like, this is the Marine Corps birthday. Do you think this woman's going to give me a daughter on the Marine Corps birthday? Now, I know that's chauvinistic, and I apologize, but that's what I said. Okay, it was before I became the kinder, gentler human that I am today. And he looks at me like, I'm like the stupidest asshole on the planet, right? And so Susan produces Patrick. And Patrick comes out. I look, and I look at him, and I put my hands up in the air, right? I'm like, boo! And he's just like, you're stupid. I saw Duffy White, so that's in the morning. I go down. I pick up our oldest son, John, who was 3. We're going back to Bethesda in the evening. I see Duffy White on the interstate. And he looks at me, and he, like, gives me, like, what the fuck's going on? And he said, oh, Susan had the baby? And I said, yep. Patrick Francis, man, swinging a chain. And so, but at that ball, we had an air officer by the name of J.R. His call sign was J.R. I can't remember what his last name was. So the commandant is making his comments, and he's sitting at the center table, right, in the room, and he's facing the commandant, and he pukes, right? He pukes on the table during the commandant's, right, remark. So the commandant's speaking, and he's sitting there, and then the guy wasn't there, and they tell me, all of a sudden, he had this, as he tried to stifle it, and then he projectiled it onto the table. Now, you know, that's not something you experience every day, right?
Yeah.
Let alone with women at the table. And the women, like, immediately, like, snatch their stuff off the table, and they recoil, and everybody reacted, and the commandant stopped his speech. He says, I think he needs some help. Right? And then JR, who got nominated for AI of the Month because of that, which is an award you get for doing something really stupid and you have to defend yourself, he stands up and he says, look, I don't know why I'm being victimized because I got some bad eyes. You know, this. So it became the bad ice event. But yeah, I don't, and then I'm not going to name him because he later became a colonel, but he brings a stripper to the ball. Yeah, he's a lieutenant, right? And so the lieutenants are invited. So he brings a stripper. And so she's a pretty girl, and her dress is constantly falling off. Like, so it's a spaghetti strap dress, and he's put her up to it, right? And he said, look, just wiggle out of your dress and don't catch it till it gets to about your waist. And you can imagine how that went over. Like a lead balloon among, like, wives and girlfriends. But it was awesome.
Was that 91, or what was that, Mac?
Well, that would have been 90, 91, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but let me tell you. So that's why I call it the prom gone wrong. You have, like, it looks like this really respectable and beautiful event. It is not. It is like Pacers, just a kiss away from getting sideways, upside down, and stupid in a hurry, which is why we love it so much.
Yeah, it's like the balls on Embassy Duty are great. Like that picture I sent you of us up there, that was during the Marine Corps ball of 1977. And nothing really bad happened there because we didn't want to get punched in the stomach. Like, that. But yeah, he was good. He was good for, you know, the after ball. We went to his house and he made eggs for everybody.
That way you could throw those eggs up.
Oh yeah, it was. You know how to have a good time, you know. That whole drunken Marine Corps ball thing is for sure. You know, and I didn't even go to the first Marine Corps ball test. The first one I went to was that one in 1977. I came in 75. Matter of fact, one time I was the youngest guy. My first one, I just turned 18, so they had me be the youngest guy, cut the cake, and then they told me to leave.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I hate being the oldest guy. I'm going to Vegas tomorrow night to speak at one.
Ew.
Yeah, Caesar's Palace. Marine Wing Support Squadron, something like that, out of Pendleton. And but they've got a grunt sergeant major, and he called me up and he said, hey sir, I'd love for you to come be our guest of honor and speak at the ball. I said, I'd love to. And then I'm going to do post-traumatic winning again for a group of, training leaders for the Clark County / Las Vegas Fire Department. I'll do that on Friday morning. So, big couple of days. And then over to Yuma to do it on Monday.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I got a call from the Air Force yesterday afternoon. Hey, we want you to come to Hawaii a few times. I'm like, I've never been.
And it's so.
Yeah.
Not Hawaii. No, not again.
I've never been to Hawaii.
Really?
Never. Never been to Hawaii. And so anyway, and then I'm working with the town that I call my hometown, which is up in North Dakota. I called them and said, hey, look, I'm doing this thing all over the country. I'd love to. And they said, well, you know, the mayor's got a big mental health initiative. We'd love to, you know, you guys would create, you know, a buzz in the community. And it's a town of about 70,000 people. But the suicide rate among farmers is crazy for all the same reasons, man. They don't talk about it. You know, your crop goes against you for a number of years, and you're borrowed, you're leveraged to the hilt, and now you're going to be the guy who has to sell a farm that's been in your family for four generations.
Yeah, I should see that.
That's hard.
Yeah, and then, you know, the proud guys who don't say shit, you know, I'll work my way out of this, and then they can't, and then they the suicide rate among farmers is horrible. So, yeah, so cool stuff. And then, like I said, over to Yuma on Monday, and then I think I'm done for a while. But I'm going to write two books before the end of the year. I'm going to write the post-traumatic winning book, which is in my head. I just got to excrete it. And I'm going to write that children's book before the end of the year, too. And so my motivating force is Viktor Frankl wrote Man's Search for Meaning in 9 days.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is phenomenal.
Yeah. So that's my motivating shit. Right? That's my motivating shit. Yeah. You know, one of the things about that story that makes me laugh, right, is Jeff, when you say, so I go outside, I'm getting my shit hot. Right?
Yeah.
I don't know why that makes me laugh. But it just does, right? I can picture you with those fucking you taking off your glasses, right? Like, what were you doing? Cracking your knuckles? Like,
I don't know. It's like when I got blown up, all this shit that happened in Bethesda, I got to go off where other people come because I don't remember shit. And then that one, I was so drunk, I don't remember that. But let me tell you, the other Marines fucking all clued me in excruciating detail of every stupid word I said and everything. Oh, yeah, you were like, you know, you were stretching your arms over your head and throwing jabs, like, at the air and shit, you know, and, you know, taking off your glasses and, you know, putting it on the fucking, you know, picnic table there, and, oh, yeah.
You know, when we were back in Iowa City, I bet I've sparred with Jeff 50, 75 rounds total over that years. And Jeff knows how to throw a friggin' hook. I mean, he is formidable when sober.
I thought I was until I fought Don Vito, and the fucking guy hit so hard it went bald.
Well, that was the thing, is we fought each other, then we had to, you know, nobody could do anything to Don Vito. That was just not going to happen. It was just a question of how much punishment he wanted to give you.
Yes, and then he was like it. Amir Rutledge go over there, and he knocks us both out in the third round. You know, I mean, hit us so hard, we fucking went down.
Hey, can
both
I,
of us,
explain,
same time in the third round.
Explain to everybody who Gunny Don Vito was, and then what was his background?
Well, I'll let Timmy do that because I know it, but Timmy's, right. You know, Tim's the guy who brought him. I think Tim and his dad are the one who brought Gunny Don Vito to us. You know, so go
ahead, exactly right. That's exactly right. My dad took over Paris Island at the time that I was an SPC, you know, an India company and then Fox company. So he was in Paris Island, and he was revamping because the Marine Corps was constantly looking for some type of combatives program that was you could teach and was practical to do without a lot of extensive retraining and stuff. Right. And so the guy that ran close combat was a gunnery sergeant named Don Vito at Paris Island, and he had come up with this system that he called a line, linear infighting neural engagement override, and he just made that crap up. He goes, look, if you want to give it a name, it's a name. But if you remember, it basically centered, it was really Krav Maga. It was kicks and then arm bars on the necks and throwing people. So you could, it was designed that you could train full contact, full speed, and do these moves on each other. That was the whole purpose of the program. But when I got a chance to go down there, not paid, but TDY, I went down there and stayed at the old man's house, which was fun. And I went to go train with Don Vito, and I remember the first morning, cause he's a short 5'8" maybe, but he's a stock of massive guy. And he's got these glasses and this really innocent baby boy look about him that is deceptive. He probably looked like Jeff when he was younger too. And he's got these glasses and he looks at me and goes, are you here to train or are you here to watch, sir? I said, I'm here to train. He goes, oh, Okay, we'll come back here at 1300. Drink a lot of water between now and then. You can watch right now. And he brings in a guy from the 3rd Battalion who I did not know he did not like and crushes him in 4 rounds. I mean, they had to carry this guy out. And I'm like, he goes, yeah, it's your turn at 1300, sir. I'm like, what the fuck? So in order to learn the line, you had to go through his instructor initiation, which was body sparring. And body sparring involved no shots to the head. It was shots to the body that if it rocked you enough that you lost your winner or hurt you, you stuck your hands out, you got 30 seconds reprieve. Okay? If not, the shots just kept on coming, and your job was, of course, to deliver shots back and try to keep this human buzzsaw off you, which was incredibly difficult to do. The only advantage I had is I had boxed in the Navy. I'd been a light heavyweight, and I boxed for 3 years, boxed at AAU and whatnot. So I had some fundamentals down, and he did not make me stick my hands out that first day, but that was only because he didn't want to. He didn't want me to.
Right.
And I knew it. And so then I learned the line program, and I thought it was good General Allen hated the way we were doing it with this running through a trail and hitting each other with sticks and bullshit, and he wanted something else, and so that's where the room of pain came from. And I said, no, what we do is we do what you do with your instructors, and we make the lieutenants think, because if like against Don Vito, they had to fight an enlisted guy and an officer guy. If they were smart, knowing that we were going to be in there for 2 hours and we got a pretty solid defense, if when the bell rings, I go to the corner and wait, what the hell are you attacking me for? You've got a 2-hour evolution in front of you, and you're going to burn up your energy hitting my gloves? You know, that was the kind of thought process we were trying to instill in the lieutenants, and I think we had some success with it. But I tell you what, that those guys left there having taken a shot or two if they never had before. Because Don Vito was punishing.
Because I'm thinking body sparring, because Timmy is telling me about it on the mortar range. So yeah. I'm thinking body shot, how bad could it be? Oh, it can be bad.
Jesus.
Somehow he could throw this left hook that hit you in the fucking kidney or near it, and your fucking legs just went down, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was like a dog. There was nothing you can do. He never did that to Killer, because he respected Killing, because Killing could fight. Killing was tough as shit. And
Killian,
I don't think he did it to you, Jeff. I don't think he ever dropped you either, because he liked you too a lot.
Yeah. Mike,
but he did to me.
Mike had this thing that he would do in a bar, and he was giving a class on it one day. And I don't know what we were doing. We were out doing something and talking shit. And he goes, no. He goes, watch this. He says, I've perfected this move when I'm going to punch somebody, right? And he said, and I don't do this very often because Mike was good with his hands, right? He's a boss. I mean, Mike, he's a tough guy. He's good.
Boxed the academy.
Yeah, I just saw him.
He knocked Steve Chill out when he was in the academy and Chill was in VMI.
But Killer would say, he said, so the thing is to get your feet right, and you got to get your right hand cocked, okay? He said, so when you're going to smoke somebody, right, you take a step back, right, you get your feet right underneath you, you put both your hands up adjacent to your ears, and you say, hey, buddy, I've got no problem with you. Now, your shoulders have to be, they can't be, you know, at a 90-degree angle relative to him, right? They've got to be at a 45-degree angle, right? So he said, your feet are positioned, your hand in particular, your right hand is by your ear, okay? And you're going to say, hey, man, I got no issues with you. I don't want to fight, right? And we're sitting there going, yeah. And then what? He said, and then you don't even have to take a step. Drive off your back, the ball of your back foot, and knock him the fuck out.
He said, there's art to bar fighting, for sure.
Oh, my God. And he was like, he was hilarious. And the Killer's got to dip in. He's telling the story. Yeah. And he said, so if you ever hear me in a bar say, I got no problem with you, buddy. I don't want to fight. He said, that's the preparatory command, okay? That's the preparatory command. Oh, my God. He was hilarious.
The beauty of implementing Sun Tzu's philosophies in your personal defensive strategy. That's great.
Oh, my God. But no, he was great. He was great. The, let's see. Are we done? Any Veterans Day stories? Do you guys, I mean, normally for Marines, Veterans Day is not a big deal because, you know, our day's the day before.
Yeah,
and
back.
Yeah, we're just glad we have the day off to recover.
Yeah.
That's what Veterans Day is for Marines. It's a day of recovery.
Yep.
Well, we cut the birthday cake on, what the hell? No, we did it on Sunday. No, we did it on Sunday at the 5x5 brewery out in the parking lot there with a band and everything.
Did you? Five.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Let me tell you, man, that never gets old, and Marines never get tired of doing that shit.
Hey, you know, I got to tell you, Tim, remind me of something. I got a happy birthday text from Chris Dowling. And then he said, you know, happy birthday. He invited me down there for some kind of leadership forum. So I'm going to take Lori and get on there, man. So I'll hook up with you, you know. I don't know when. He's got to tell me the date, but it's going to be pretty soon.
Oh, yeah. They do a big deal for Iwo Jima for the 75th birthday. I'll be out there for that. We're going to be out in force. But yeah, Chris has got a, he's got an interesting thing over there. They get a lot of international students in.
No shit.
I was surprised. Oh yeah. China comes from Mexico and China.
We got to cut this short today because, not short, we were going an hour, but, a friend of ours, Chris Bronzi, is going to take command of the 13th MU. I think.
Fantastic.
And,
fantastic.
So it's going to be a chance for, Dave Furness going to come out for this. So our buddies are going to be kind of assemble. Guys like Ted Greeley, Terrible Ted, will be there. And guys, it'll be like an IOC festival. And
yes.
then a bunch of guys from RCT1 are going to be there because Chris was part of that. And so it's going to be a great afternoon, but I got to get going and I got to stop and get a haircut. And so I got to get going. And Jeff, you're going to be there, yes?
Yeah, I'm like 100 yards away from where we're going to do this thing right now.
And I met Chris in Ramadi in 2004. Paul Kennedy said, buddy, you got to come meet one of my company commanders, right? I'm going to get him to IOC. You know, he's a stud, right? And so.
He had already been at IOC.
No, that's right. That's right. That's right. And so, yeah, he's an IOC guy. You got to meet him. So we go out to, I tag along. Kelly one day says, hey, you want to go see Kennedy? He's going to meet me out at Combat Outpost. And I said, yeah. So we go over there. And now Bronzy's with Kelly. And I'm walking with Kennedy. And we're just shooting shit, right? And Bronzy and Kelly are about, now Kennedy's the assistant division commander. Kelly's the assistant division commander. And Bronzy's just showing him around. We're walking the perimeter and whatnot. All of a sudden you hear, and just, you can hear mortars when they're pointed at you, right?
Yeah.
You can hear the ping, it's more clear, right? And your ear knows it. And all of a sudden you hear, dee, 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 dee. And I look at Kennedy and he goes, buddy, those are aimed at us. So we turn and we start running. There's 6 120 mortars land inside Combat Jeez. Outpost. And Kelly, they must have been tracking Kelly somehow or other. Kelly and Bronzy are running, and then they start shooting machine guns. Somebody that was in one of the outposts got hit, right? And then, these Lance Corporals start loading up the QR up. Now, mind you, this is before we had up armored Humvees. These things were Frankenstein. They were quarter thick inch, metal, like tied and somehow they're, you know, tied to the sides of these things. There was no teacup up above. The Marine with the machine gun, the 240, he's got the bipod legs down on the rubberized canvas top of the Humvee, right? It's the open back with the side seats in it. And they're all jumping up and they're screaming and yelling. And it's like, it's so made you want to be a Lance Corporal. And they're like, let's fucking go. This is the third fucking time these motherfuckers are going to pay, right? And so the dude, right, the machine gunner, I'm just standing watching him going, fuck, I hate my life, right? And he's putting on his sleeveless black glove, right? And he's got a cigarette in, and he's smoking it. The 240's on the hood of the vehicle, and he looks around. So he's somebody senior, right? He goes, let's fucking go, boys. they're gonna fucking pay. They're gonna fucking pay. Now the kid that's on the end, and you know they do this all the time, right? So everybody's got a seat in the vehicle, right? It's not like random, like festival seating, right? It's like everybody's got a spot. So he's sitting there, and he's got this Tootsie Pop, I think, sucker sticking out of his teeth. And I'm like, what the fuck? And I thought that the stick was coated. I'm like, is that some kind of candy coating on a stick? No, it was dirt and grime and shit, right? And he's got this thing in his mouth. He's missing a tooth, and the fucking thing's sticking through his teeth. And he's looking at me, and he's smiling, and he goes, you want to go with us, don't you, sir? I said, so fucking bad you don't even know it. He said, sir, this is the fucking best. And with that, his buddy hops down to his right, so towards the cab. And without even saying anything, they lock feet, right? So he won't fall out the back. But they don't even say, like, the one dude sits down and he sticks his foot out. The other dude wraps his foot around. And then somebody yelled, I can't remember. I think somebody yelled, the squad leader yelled condition one. And you hear that. I don't know. That's the sound I want played at my funeral. Right?
Yeah.
It is fucking motivation. Let's go, boys. And they take off, and you're just like, those are men, right? Mm-hmm. Those are fucking men. But that's where I met Chris Bronzy. And then we spent a year together in Afghanistan, and we're great friends. He worked, Jeff, you meet him. He's one of your instructors at IOC, right?
Well, first he was one of my lieutenants for about a week in Tutu.
Holy shit.
He showed up by IOC. So I had him for a little while, and I said, hey, man, I'm sorry that your first experience, you know, in the fleet is going to be in heavy guns because, you know, he really wanted to be a rifle platoon commander. They all did. I go, but you know what? Marines are Marines, and you could do a lot of damage to these fucking things. And hopefully my career won't end out there in Pittsburgh. I'll see you again. And then it didn't end out there in Pittsburgh. And 4 years later, he came to work for me. He's up at Quantico as an SPC. And he came over as an IOC instructor after I'd been there about three or four months. I got him. And he was great, man. That fucking laugh of his.
Oh, my God.
Here's a quick Bronzy story, right? My oldest stepson was in 1-5. And this is before the war. This was like 2000 and late 2001, you know? And they come to visit him and his wife, us in Quantico. I lived in Stafford. So Lori goes, well, I'm going to drop something off with Jeff at Mitchell Hall. You guys just come with us, you know. And he goes, ah, Mom, you know, I'm on leave and I didn't shave. I don't want to hear from behind me. Hey, Devil Dog. He goes, oh, you're not going to hear any of that. Just stay in the car. We'll go to the Mitchell Hall and then we'll go out in town, you know, whatever they're going to do. So they get to Mitchell Hall, and Lori flounces up to give me whatever she's going to give me. And there's, like, they had gone to McDonald's the day before, so there's trash in the car. So I guess his wife or maybe even Lori harangued him to just throw it in the dumpster right there in the parking lot.
Right.
He gets out. He walks three steps, and he hears, hey, Devil Dog, and it's Captain Chris Bronzy. And Bronzy goes, I bet you stay a little closer. I'm fucking ready to lay there, Marie. But I'm like, He does a different thing, but yeah, it was pretty fun.
No, let me tell you, and he's a Leftwich Award winner, which
yes,
is for the top company commander. And let me tell you, my sons, like, they worship at the altar of Joker 6. And that's Chris's call sign. And it's unbelievable. In fact, Patrick, who knows, you know, Chris well. And Chris wrote letters for Patrick to get in the Marine Corps and whatnot, and he's been kind of a mentor to Patrick. Patrick asked Chris, could you talk to one of my friends? He's a captain and looking for some career advice. And so we're up in Las Vegas. For Patrick turned 30 last weekend. He and his fiance flew out. His fiance doesn't tell him and tells us, hey, will you meet us in Las Vegas, have dinner with him? So they come into this restaurant. His buddy was with him and his fiance, and then they come around the corner. We're all sitting there, like, surprise. So it was a great weekend. Anyway, you should hear him talk about, like, meeting Chris Bronzy. This kid, he's a captain in the Marine Corps. It's like he went to, like, heaven. So I go to the mock to meet Colonel Bronzy, and I see my old IOC instructor, the head of IOC, the group chief when I was there. Right. And so he knows me as a second lieutenant shithead. Right. And so we're talking, and he was PTing, and he says, what are you doing over here? And he said, oh, I'm here to see Colonel Bronzy. And he said, now the guy looks at him like, who the fuck are you? Like, to see Colonel Bronzy. So then he goes inside, and there's a couple IOC instructors of his from the same period. And they're shooting the shit with him. Hey, Cebulski, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. I'm good, good. What are you doing here? I'm supposed to see Colonel Bronzy. And they're like, oh, shit. I'm like, he's like, sir, my stock went up so much just because because I went to see him. And I said, okay, look, I don't worship at the altar of Joker 6, okay? He's as much of a shithead as everybody else, okay? He just, he's an awesome dude.
I want to add one story because I only met Bronzy briefly with you guys when you were at a Dwyer, right? And you introduced him. And then I asked, and I said, did I hear that right? Were you were Paul Kennedy? Was your battalion commander? He goes, oh, yes, sir. And I said, and Jeff Kenny, you were, and I said, you lucky bastard. And just because I was friends with Paul Kennedy, Jeff, you, and Furness, that guy treated me like gold ever since. He's been very, very friendly. It was funny because it works the other way around too. Because he didn't know me from I show up there in Afghan clothes and a .45 caliber pistol, and people are likely to wonder what the exactly the hell I was up to, you know. But he treated me very well, and I give him my best today, please.
It's gonna be a fun day. All right, boys, thanks for the visit.
All righty.
We have a Jeff Kenny and Tim Lynch here on a Thursday. More of Armoring Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Thursday, that'll do it. Headed down to a change of command to see a good friend take over a big-time Marine Corps unit. So, very cool. Very cool stuff. Well, looking forward to it. And then the other cool thing that happens is it's like a convention. Like, all your friends are there because you all somehow or other get networked. And so looking forward to that as well. So have a great day. Don't touch that dial. More of Armoring Radio coming up next. Right here on your home for Armoring Radio. The All Warrior Radio Network. So on a Thursday, we are over and out.